It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. COVID-19 vaccines approved by the FDA have been available for weeks, but for those who aren't frontline healthcare workers, confusion is mounting. The process of vaccine distribution has been a patchwork of government authorities and healthcare systems. WESA health reporter Sarah Bowden is going to try to help us clear up the confusion. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin. Nice to talk to you.
Sarah, as of this week, who is eligible for getting vaccinated in Allegheny County in Pennsylvania?
Right. So as you mentioned, healthcare workers are, of course, are still eligible. They've been eligible since the beginning. That's also true for staff and residents of long-term care facilities. But last week, the State Department of Health expanded its eligibility criteria to bring it in line with the federal government. So now people who are 65 and older, along with Pennsylvanians who have certain health conditions like cancer, pregnancy, and sickle cell disease can technically get the vaccine.
Technically. So they're eligible, but are they getting it?
Generally, people, especially those in the recently added groups, are not getting vaccinated.
So, Sarah, the demand is there, but not the supply?
You know, that's a bit of a mystery, Kevin, and it really varies throughout the U.S. In some parts of the country, there is a shortage of people to administer the vaccine. At least locally, the director of Allegheny County's health department, along with the county's healthcare systems, all say that the holdup is a lack of vaccine doses, and therefore the focus really has to be on healthcare workers right now. But it's a messy and complicated picture.
We've heard reporting from you and other colleagues that it seems that health system employees who do not work in hospitals are getting vaccinated before even some frontline healthcare workers who aren't employed by the big hospital systems. Is that still happening, do you know?
I believe it is still happening. From an infection prevention standpoint, it makes total sense to vaccinate anyone and everyone who works in a medical facility, but UPMC has also been vaccinating its employees who don't work in medical facilities, and some of whom have been working from home since the start of the pandemic.
You mentioned earlier that the state has rules. So how is it that some people who don't seem like they would be in phase 1A are getting the vaccine?
Well, UPMC says it's important for it to keep its workforce healthy so it can deliver health care. And apparently this includes people in departments like fundraising and finance and communications. The county health department says it doesn't have much oversight. And regarding state enforcement, Dr. Wendy Braun, who is Pennsylvania's interim acting physician general, said there is no order that compels vaccine administrators like UPMC to comply with the state's vaccine plan. So when a health system or a pharmacy or whoever gets the vaccine, they can administer that as to how they see fit.
Allegheny County on Friday started signups for vaccinations at a site in Monroeville for this week. Reservations ran out in an hour. What does that signal to you about future attempts at vaccine distribution?
Well, simply that demand is super high. On the one hand, it's frustrating because people who desperately need the vaccine and who have been waiting for a very long time have to wait longer, even though technically they're eligible to get the vaccine. But also, to me, it signals that vaccine hesitancy perhaps is lower in our county. That's hard to say, but it's great that interest in getting vaccinated is so high, because for the vaccine to really work, we need the majority of people to get their shots.
The state does not have a centralized scheduling system. They've got a map with dots on it, supposedly distributors of the vaccine. So it could be the health systems. It could be Giant Eagle Pharmacies. That's more options, but might those options sort of add to the confusion?
I think it does. It's a very fragmented system. And a lot of those dots that indicate that, you know, a provider or a pharmacy or whoever has gotten vaccine, that map doesn't say whether or not they're vaccinating the general public. For example, some Giant Eagle pharmacies have received vaccine, but it's my understanding they're not really vaccinating the general public right now. They're using that vaccine to focus on long-term care facilities and, in some cases, healthcare workers.
So, Sarah, right now, if you're in phase 1A, what's the best advice to find out when and where? call your doctor, call your insurance provider, the state health department.
I mean, everyone should talk to their doctor. Their doctor probably has very little to tell them about when they'll be eligible, but that's a good place to start. I would try pharmacies, especially independent pharmacies, and then maybe community health centers. The people who will get vaccinated first, who fall into this expanded 65 plus category, as well as those who have underlying health conditions, are the people that have the means and the time. It's not going to be an easy, oh, I'll just call up Rite Aid or Giant Eagle and get scheduled. You have to be calling and monitoring social media. You know, if you work, if you have to do childcare, if you have limited access to the internet, you know, this is a system that, because it's so complicated, will advantage people who are more privileged.
Sarah Bowden is WESA's health and science reporter. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As COVID-19 vaccinations continue, we're all wondering, who's next? When will it be my turn? But for pregnant mothers, the guidance is less clear-cut. One of the criticisms of the test trials of the vaccines was the lack of data on the efficacy and impact of those vaccines when it comes to pregnancy. Dr. Richard Begge is an obstetrician, and he's the president of UPMC McGee Women's Hospital, and just published a piece in the journal Vaccine about why vaccine trials must include pregnant women. Dr. Begge, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about this important topic.
Doctor, why are pregnant women excluded from vaccine trials in the first place?
This goes back many decades to a pretty much a policy of exclusion. And it really started to go in this direction after some of the inadvertent tragedies that occurred in the 1960s and 1970s with some well-known problems, such that now that the criteria really look to give criteria for who should be included. And what myself and many others have thought for years is that when you have products that are being developed that you have no reasons to believe may be harmful, we really would like to see this go to more of a pattern of reasons for exclusion. So it would be more of an inclusive approach overall.
In your paper, you point out that not explicitly designing the vaccination research with pregnant women or including opportunities for women who become pregnant to stay in the trial, quote, perpetuates a cycle of exclusion and evidence gaps. What do you mean by that?
Well, the approach of outright exclusion creates a situation where you never have the data that you wanted at the outset like you do for other populations. Because of that, some providers and some women indeed are less likely or less inclined to take the vaccine. So then that also perpetuates less use and also less data to be gathered in that manner. So it's kind of a catch-22. If you don't have the data, then people are unlikely or unwilling to use it, then you still have that lack of data conundrum. But what does happen is what's happening now is that pregnant women are using these vaccines, which I agree with, but it would be more optimal to have some of that data up front to make a more educated, allow these women to make more educated decisions and allow providers to make more educated recommendations.
As an obstetrician, is there any sense that you have that pregnant women would be willing to take part in vaccine trials out of concern for themselves and, of course, their babies?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. We have for now 15 plus years at McGee Women's done trials with pregnant women for candidate medications. And you're right that not all pregnant women really want to take part in these studies. But there are, you know, non-insignificant groups of pregnant women that are willing to when you talk to them about why you're doing it. And they have confidence that you've designed the studies in a very thoughtful and safe manner.
What do we know right now about the risks of contracting COVID-19 while pregnant?
We know that the risks of acquiring it do not appear to be higher when you're pregnant. But what some of the data from the United States shows that if pregnant women do become symptomatic with COVID, they appear to have more risk of having more severe disease. This is not terribly unexpected. We know this from other infectious diseases. The magnitude of risk appears to be less than pregnant women have from influenza, but nevertheless, it does appear to be elevated when you compare them to their non-pregnant peers.
Let's talk about breastfeeding mothers. They pass on some immunities to their baby. Do you expect mothers vaccinated for COVID-19 could pass that protection to their child?
Yes, that is a possibility. You're absolutely right that breastfeeding does pass on natural antibodies to the baby and offers protection against a variety of respiratory and gastrointestinal infections. To answer that specific question for COVID-19 vaccine, we would have to study that more directly. In addition to that, there's no reason to believe that a mother with COVID-19 should not breastfeed her baby. We have recommended early on that mothers with COVID-19, if they choose to, they should breastfeed their babies. There does not appear to be any risk of transmitting it.
We know the coronavirus is disproportionately affecting people of color. When it comes to designing vaccine trials for pregnant women, how do we ensure the research includes women of all ethnicities, races?
I think that's a great question. And I think you want to be deliberate and make sure you're sampling a representative population and to include racial and ethnic minorities so that when the study's done and the data comes out, it represents in a fair manner your population, and you can make safe recommendations and adequate recommendations for all populations.
I'm sure that it varies from specific patient to specific patient. As an obstetrician, overall, would you recommend your patients get the vaccination?
I would. I don't think there's a real reason to think there's harm. I think there's clear potential benefits for women to take these vaccines. I, of course, respect this as an individual decision. So my job would be to counsel them with what I just told you and also work with them on their own belief structure. But to answer your fundamental question, I believe it's safe and I think it's highly effective. Given what we know about this virus and pregnancy, I would recommend that they take it.
Dr. Richard Begge is an obstetrician and he's president of UPMC McGee Women's Hospital. Dr. Begge, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk today.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mary Lee Williams. Every holiday season, Western Pennsylvania bird enthusiasts venture out for the yearly bird count. The Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania still conducted its count this year with some modifications. Brian Shima is the organization's operations director. So, Brian, what did this year's count reveal?
During the count, which was done on December 26th, by the way, we found 78 species of birds for a total of 24,522 individuals.
So how does that compare to other years?
We have been noticing over the course of the last decade or so that our 10-year average is increasing. About a decade ago, we had about a 68 or 69 bird average, species average. This year, our average is actually up to 73 species, and there's actually a pretty easy way of explaining why this is happening. There are a number of species of birds that we are finding more regularly here in Pittsburgh during the winter. Things such as turkey vulture, northern raven, fish crow, eastern towhee, and chipping sparrow are all species that a decade or two decades ago, we never would have found during this count. However, in recent years, we are finding them generally every year. So those species, for example, are pushing our 10-year average upward from the high 60s to the low to mid 70s. And so it's really interesting to kind of watch this. We're seeing actually in real time, many of these birds' ranges are expanding. Where they would normally have wintered south of Pennsylvania, they're now being found right here in Pittsburgh during the winter. In addition, this year happened to be a bit different than previous years in that we consider this to be what's called an eruption year. During certain winters, the fir and spruce trees in the northern boreal forest do not produce as many cone seeds. When that happens, the birds that rely on those cone seeds for their winter forage will actually begin to move southward. So this year, there was a number of finches that we found on the Pittsburgh count that sort of that sort of highlight those birds highlight the fact that there is an eruption and birds moving south for the winter. And then, of course, every year we find a few birds in Pittsburgh that really shouldn't be here. And there's two great examples that we found this year. The first is black scoter, and black scoter is a duck species, and it is a bird that normally migrates through western Pennsylvania and is out in the ocean by this time of the year. They're generally a coastal species, and they winter along the Atlantic coast. We had three of them that we found on the Allegheny River near Blawnox. And another example is Baltimore Oriole. That's a familiar bird for many bird watchers here in western Pennsylvania in the summertime. They winter way south of Pennsylvania. We had a single individual Baltimore Oriole that has remained in Pittsburgh and is visiting a bird feeder in the city of Pittsburgh. So 78 species for the Pittsburgh bird count is quite high. In fact, it's the second highest that we've ever found in the history of the count.
Does the range expansion, is this normal or natural to you, or is this something that's actually kind of concerning?
It is somewhat natural given climate change. And, you know, some of these birds are worse already headed in our direction, that we've been watching their ranges expand. Northern raven and fish crow are great examples. We've been watching those two species, the range expand toward Pittsburgh for several years. And, you know, just over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, have we begun finding them during our Christmas bird count annually.
I assume you participated in the bird count. What was the most exciting bird that you got to see when counting this year?
So I happened to find two of the three Eastern Towhees that we recorded for the count. I participate here in Fox Chapel, and I spend about 6 or 7 hours in the field. I've carved out a large portion of Fox Chapel that I'm very, very familiar with, that a number of the homeowners have gotten to know me over the years. So if they see me parked in front of their house and I'm looking at their bird feeders, they know who I am. And I found one of the Eastern Towhees right here at the Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania's Beechwood Farms Nature Reserve. In fact, the bird is still here. I just saw it again yesterday out in the field. And then I also found an additional Eastern Towhee sort of right dead center in the middle of Fox Chapel in a woman's backyard where I have found Eastern Towhees now for about 5 or 6 years. So I suspect perhaps the same individual or certainly same lineage that those birds are deciding to overwinter right there in her backyard.
Brian Shima is the operations director for the Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.